The talk show Africa Now airs Wednesdays at 1 p.m. It's a modern view on historic issues concerning the entire African world, addressing how African people are participating in globalization, ways in which the rest of the world continues to exploit African resources, uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now in interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available on iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
Is it bye-bye Biden, or are Democrats going to have to dance with the one that rung you? A deep dive into the Democrats' post-debate dilemma. Was it just a bad debate night, or is it cognitive decline? And if not Biden, who? Good morning and welcome to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Well, from the minute President Joe Biden shuffled onto the set and former President Donald Trump confidently strode over to the podium, the optics for the rest of that evening were set. For the following 90 or so minutes, 51 million viewers watched the Democratic presumed nominee mumble, experience a painstakingly long mid-sentence pause, make facial expressions, and at one time delivering an incoherent argument, which Trump seized that moment, retorting, "I really don't know what he said at the end of that sentence. I don't think he knows what he said either." Biden did manage to deliver a zinger of his own, calling Trump a felon and a one-man crime wave. But given his past performances, many believe that if Trump's lips are moving, he's lying. But indeed, fact debate checkers found misstatements from both candidates. According to the USA Today, fact checkers, here are some of the misleading statements that were made. On Biden's part, in a garbled statement, Biden said he lowered the price of insulin from $400 to $15, referring to his Inflation Reduction Act, which actually capped the cost of insulin at $35. Biden claimed the Border Patrol endorsed his position, whereas, in fact, the Border Patrol Union endorsed a bipartisan proposal that Biden signed, but Trump opposed. Biden said he changed the law, whereas there are 40% fewer people coming across the border illegally. In fact, the Department of Homeland Security says since Biden's actions, there are 40% fewer border encounters. And number four, Biden claimed no U.S. troops died anywhere in the world during his presidency. Untrue. 13 U.S. service members were killed in a suicide bombing attack near the Hamid Karzai International Airport in Kabul in August of 2021, when Biden was president. And more recently, three U.S. Army Reserve soldiers were killed in January at a base in Jordan in what was described as a drone attack by Iran-backed militants. Biden said historians voted Trump the worst president in history, whereas the 2024 Presidential Greatness Project expert survey, respondents voted Trump the lowest in presidential greatness. And number six, Biden said Trump told Americans to inject a little bleach into your arms and you'll be all right. Well, Trump never said inject disinfectant into your body. What he said in response to a Homeland Security expert citing a study where sunlight and disinfectant killers or disinfectants killed the virus in the air, Trump said, quote, "I saw the disinfectant where it knocks it out in 1 minute. And is there a way we could do something like that by an injection inside or almost a cleaning intro?" End quote. Well, as for Trump's 13 falsifications of fact, number one, everybody wanted Roe versus Wade overturned. That's false. In a poll conducted May 22nd before it was overturned, 64% opposed overturning it. Number two, Trump claimed if I didn't bring the National Guard in, that city, Minneapolis, would have been destroyed. That was false. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, a Democrat, activated the state's National Guard to respond to unrest following the death of George Floyd. Number three, I had the highest approval rating in the history of the Veterans Administration. false also, and misleading. The Veteran Signal Survey tracks the proportion of service members who express having trust in the VA. It's not a presidential approval rating. It's topped 80% twice, and it was 80% in 2020 during Trump's administration and reached a high of 80.4% in May under Biden. Number four, the number of drugs coming across our border now is the largest we've ever had by far. That's false. The U.S. Customs and Border Protection, Border Patrol, and Office of Field Operations seized nearly 549,000 pounds of illicit drugs in 2023. That's according to federal data. That's down 16% from 2022. Number five, he indicted me because I'm his opponent. False. Trump was indicted and convicted in New York for falsifying business records. There's no evidence the Biden administration had anything to do with the charges. As for the two federal cases against Trump, hoarding of classified documents and attempting to steal the election, Biden has remained separate from the prosecution and vowed publicly not to speak with Attorney General Garland about the specifics of the case. He also appointed a special prosecutor, Jack Smith, to add a layer of separation. Number six, I didn't have sex with a porn star. Well, Trump was found guilty of 34 felony counts of falsifying records tied to paying hush money to porn star Stormy Daniels. Number seven, quote, Trump, he did a crime bill, 1994, where you call them super predators, African-Americans, super predators, and they've never forgotten it. They've never forgotten it, end quote. That's false. Biden warned of super predators, but he never referred to African-Americans as super predators. Number eight, people are coming in and they're killing our citizens at a level we've never seen. Also false. Research suggests immigrants actually commit fewer crimes than people born in the U.S. No data supports a wave of homicides committed by illegal immigrants. The opposite, in fact, is true. NBC News reports claims crime levels have fallen in cities where Texas has transported immigrants from the border. Nine, we have a border that is the most dangerous place anywhere in the world. False, places all over the world and even the U.S. have more frequent deaths. 10, Trump claimed the corporate tax cut was down from 21% to 39%. False, he exaggerated the size of the cut. It was a cut, but from 35% to 21%, not from 39%. 11, Trump falsely represented the January 6th attack on the Capitol as a small group of people ushered in by the police. We all know the story there. 12, Trump misstated the strength of the economy during his administration. 13, Trump repeated numerous falsehoods, including that Democrats want doctors to be able to abort babies after birth. So those are Trump's falsehoods. We can see they clearly outnumbered the ones that Biden did. But just to make the point that there were some misstatements on both sides. Democrats, hoping for a strong rebuttal of Trump's lies, were frustrated by Biden's performance. Biden's told a crowd at a Waffle House stop after the debate that he had a sore throat. Well, whatever the reason, Biden's performance left untold numbers of Democratic voters, donors, and Democratic operatives, politicians feeling he's cognitively not able to win the election, creating a post-debate dilemma for the Democrats. Now, joining us this morning on What's at Stake to take a deep analysis of where the DNC goes from here are Dr. Andra Gillespie, Yale graduate, teaches political science at Emory University in Atlanta, specializes in African-American politics. This is the author of Race and the Obama Administration, Substance, Symbols, and Hope. And she's a prolific writer. Also joining us, Dr. Wilma J. Leon III, host of Connecting the Dots of Politics, another perspective. He's a political analyst and a regular contributor to national and international news programs. His expertise is black politics, American government, public policy. And also joining us in the Zoom studio is Seth, professor of political science and director of the Center of American Politics at the University of Denver. He's the author of Learning from Loss, Democrats 16 through 20. He also let's start with everyone's assessment. Good morning, all. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes. So let's start with everyone's assessment of just how bad was Biden's performance. Who thinks it was salvageable and he can just brush up his act and beat Trump? That he just had a bad debate night but he's still a winning candidate. Let's start with Dr. Andre Gillespie. Your assessment.
Well, I think the performance was very, very troubling, and I don't think that it's something that you can brush off as evidenced by the fact that we're still talking about it a week later. And part of the reason why I think we're talking about it a week later is that people have not been satisfied with the Biden campaign and administration's response to the bad performance. So it seems to be getting progressively worse. The idea that, you know, saying that he had a cold the night of, and now there are conflicting stories about President Biden being jet lagged, even though he had been back in the U.S. for more than a week before the debate. So there are all of these things that are kind of coming into play that suggests that the Biden campaign is trying to salvage and not trying to salvage very well in the situation, instead of just being forthright, not just admitting that it was a bad night, but then also kind of really addressing the issue at hand and the larger narrative that's at stake here, which is that President Biden's mental acuity has been assailed for a long period of time. And they haven't come up with a response to actually nip that in the bud. And that debate certainly didn't help matters.
I have a friend, Elizabeth White, who follows politics, and she said that event was unspinnable. So all the spin that they're attempting to do doesn't seem to be taking hold. Dr. Wilmer J. Leon III, what is your assessment of that debate?
My assessment is very consistent with Andra's assessment, except I would say it was horrible. She's just much nicer than I am. I would say that it was horrible. It's unspinnable. And one of the big issues that I have with the current analysis is this is being viewed as though it just started last week. President Biden, I have been on record for at least a year, if not a year and a half, saying he will not be the nominee and he shouldn't be the nominee because he's been in decline over time. And cognitive decline does not get better. So a lot of folks were waxing poetic and longing for the good old days of the State of the Union address back in, I think that was February. Mm-hmm. Well, no, he's declined since February. And if there is another debate in September, he'll be even worse because that's what happens. In fact, David Ignatius, back in September of 23, called for him to step aside. David Axelrod, in November of 23, said it would probably be better if another candidate stepped up. So this didn't just happen last week.
So you're sticking by your year-long prediction that he will not be the nominee.
He will not be the nominee.
Okay, we're going to get into that a little bit more. So, Seth Masket, how did you read that debate? Differently than these two guests?
I mean, I agree with my colleagues here that it was bad. It was very bad. It was. I would say that basically every incumbent president seeking re-election, almost always their first debate is pretty bad. We can go back, Barack Obama had a really off night with Mitt Romney his first time running. Donald Trump did when he was running for re-election. George W. Bush did when he was running for re-election. They almost always lose that first debate simply because they're not used to debating. It's been a while since they've actually faced anyone. Very few people actually directly challenge the president in the Oval Office, whereas their opponent has usually just come through a cycle of a bunch of primary debates and is very fresh on it. This was worse than that, though. It was bad for two particular reasons. One is that this was a format and a challenge that Biden specifically requested. He had directly challenged Trump because, for the purpose of trying to show that he was actually very much still in command, that this would presumably get some sort of a bump for him. And in fact, it just made it worse. And the other issue is that, this reinforced arguments made by a lot of pundits and political observers that have been going on for months, saying that he's really not up for this re-election task. So it added a lot of fuel to that. I have to say it bothers me somewhat that, like, you know, the media obsession over this has been talking about, I mean, you know, Biden's opponent was convicted of multiple felonies recently, and we're talking about Joe Biden stepping down. Nonetheless, that's where we are. And there are, I think, legitimate concerns about Biden's ability to do this.
Okay. So I think the concerns within the Democratic community is, yes, of course, Trump is a convicted felon, but is Biden mentally capable to have his finger on the button? Is he capable of actually leading the country? And he's a very good governor. He's governed the country extremely well. Slate columnist Zachary Carter says he did not just have a bad night. He is not fit for the job. And staying in the race would be the worst kind of vanity and betrayal. Now, end quote. Biden's record on the economy actually is exemplary. An article last month in The Atlantic by Roger Karma says if the U.S. economy were an athlete right now, it would be peak LeBron James. If it were a pop star, it would be peak Taylor Swift. He explains that America's post-pandemic performance has left other countries in the dust. Our growth rate grew twice as fast as Canada's, three times as fast as the European Union, and more than eight times as fast as the United Kingdom's. And that post-pandemic reception that Japan and Germany experienced never happened in the U.S. But according to Karma, rising inflation has increased the cost of living, and everything costs more than it did before the pandemic. So a carton of eggs costs more at the grocery store. So this is really awesome news. How come the Biden administration is not shouting this from the rooftops? Instead, they're arguing with Trump about his lies about the economy under Trump's administration. The characteristic of effective leadership is being able to deliver the message well, to inform, excite, and inspire. Trump has mastered that. Biden has not. Your thoughts about that, Dr. Andre?
So, you know, I think everything that you cite is true, but people don't feel it. And I think that that's the larger issue, is that you could say it at, on the tops of hills, and the Biden administration has tried to tout that record, but people don't feel it in the same way, in part because what they remember is that they is that a carton of eggs cost less than 2019. And some of them, even though they don't perhaps remember or consider why gas was cheaper in 2020 than it is now, still look back at those things. And they still feel a certain type of economic precarity. And interest rates have gone up, which means that, you know, you don't have 3% mortgage rates anymore. And lots of people cannot buy starter homes, and they're seeing the cost of housing go up and other types of things. So, yes, so while the fundamentals are true, we are not comparing ourselves to Canada and Japan. We don't know what's going on there. We only know what we feel here. And this is happening at a time where there's a lot of misinformation and disinformation out there. And so what people remember is getting transfer payments in late 2020 to help tide them over during COVID. And some people actually think that that's Trump doing them a solid, as opposed to responding to a national and international emergency and recognizing that those were supposed to be one-offs. That's not coming back if he gets elected president again, because God forbid we don't want another pandemic.
Anyone else want to respond to that?
Well, a big problem with this is, and I have to take issue a bit with my colleague, Andra, is that the numbers aren't good. And comparing the United States economy to Canada and the European Union and Britain, you know, I'm faster than a five-year-old, but I'm not faster than Noah Lyles in the 200 meters. I noticed he didn't compare the United States economy to China's. He didn't compare the United States economy to Russia's. We were supposed to decimate the ruble. We were supposed to turn the ruble into rubble. And now the ruble is one of the strongest currencies on the international market. There are two economies. There's the financialized economy, and then there's the industrialized economy. And the financialized economy in the United States is doing great. If you have a 401k plan, you are as happy as a clam. But if you are getting a wage, and you have to go to the store and buy a dozen eggs, a loaf of bread, and a gallon of milk, you are appalled at how much things actually cost. They cost more now. Inflation is killing us. And the Treasury's response to inflation has been the wrong response. Trying to control inflation with interest rates is not the answer. Talking about the European Union economy, well, the United States blew up the Nord Stream pipeline, which has decimated the European economy with the increase in the cost of gas, which natural gas, which a lot of the industry in Europe uses for manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
So the numbers are horrible, and the Biden administration isn't actually reflecting and using the correct data.
Actually, and in that article, he does address the fact that inflation has a serious impact on the cost of living vis-a-vis those increases in the way the economy is doing. So, Seth Masket, your thoughts about this. Is the Biden administration effectively communicating what it is doing or not?
So, I might disagree slightly with Wilmer on this, but the overall numbers right now, in terms of GDP growth, in terms of inflation, which was high but is now much more traditionally where it's been for a long time, around 3%. We've had very low unemployment for a number of years now. These are all numbers that are consistent with a way more popular president than Joe Biden is. Usually most presidents, like, they really strive to get these kind of economic numbers because they usually mean re-election, they usually mean popularity, and that really has not translated. And this is consistent with some of what Andre was saying there about how folks don't feel it. And some of that, I think, is due to interest rates, and some of that is just due to the fact there's still just persistent sticker shock. In the sense that even if inflation is not high now, people remember when the prices were a lot more affordable just a couple of years ago. And I don't know how much of it is really due to communications. I mean, Biden did not obviously at the debate communicate very effectively about the economic accomplishments of his administration. In other speeches he's done, in other speeches his cabinet members have done, in a lot of their public communications and the campaign's communications, they have made this case, and there's only so much that good messaging can do. It's hard to really convince people that the economy is good when they don't believe it. And we've seen that in the past somewhat. I mean, this was something that President Bush Sr. struggled with in 1992 when he was running for re-election. The economy was recovering. He was working really hard to convince people of that, and they just did not buy it. So it's hard to convince people of that.
Okay, so you don't see that as a lack in terms of the leadership qualifications of President Biden. Well, you know, let's not forget that Biden was behind Trump in the polls going into the debate. This was, the debate was supposed to slingshot him ahead of Trump. Did it? Did any good come out of this debate for Biden? Anybody?
No.
Don't all speak at once.
No. In fact, if you go to... if you go to Real Clear Politics, and I tend to go there, it's a simple aggregate of polling. 65% of people in the country believe that it's headed in the wrong direction. Only 25% of people polled, and this is an aggregation of a number of polls, believe that the country is going in the right direction. And 57%, I'm rounding up, 57% of people disapprove of Biden's approval rating when only 39% approve. Joe Biden did himself an incredible disservice with this last. In my opinion, can't even call it a debate. It was a discussion between two individuals. I think to represent it as a debate is a misrepresentation.
Actually, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Andre.
No, go ahead, Seth. If you want to jump in.
If you're looking for any good news for him, the fact that Biden's numbers didn't go down more is kind of striking. just because A, yes, we agree he did poorly. B, that's been the overwhelming media coverage, is how poorly Biden did relative to Trump. And I've seen all sorts of numbers suggesting, you know, the percentage of Americans who are convinced Biden is not up for the job, that he's not mentally fit or whatever. Those numbers went up after the debate. But in terms of just the polling matchup between him and Trump, that's actually barely budged. So, you know, the one bit of the slice of good news there is that this doesn't necessarily change people's minds about who they want their president to be. But it wasn't, those numbers weren't great for Biden in the first place. If he was hoping to improve those numbers, this definitely did not do it.
In fact, some other folks' numbers improved. It seems like Vice President Kamala Harris's numbers have improved. Now she's only 2 percentage points behind Trump in the polls, so she's closer to Biden, closer to Trump than Biden actually is in terms of beating him in polling. So former Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi said in an interview with MSC's Andrea Mitchell, it's a legitimate question to ask if was this an episode or part of a condition, and that both candidates, or whatever test you want to put them to in terms of their mental acuity and their health, both of them. Pelosi is still a prominent member of the House Democratic Caucus, and she added that she has full confidence in President Biden and looks forward to attending his inauguration in 2025. Another high-ranking influential political operative, Representative Jim Clyburn of South Carolina, credited as having largely delivered the votes that put Biden over the top in his state in 2020, told Andrea Mitchell that he would endorse Vice President Kamala Harris if Biden were to step aside in November's election. He went on to say, I want this ticket to continue to be Biden-Harris, and then we'll see what happens after the next election. Biden plans to speak with Democratic governors likely today following a call that governors had amongst themselves, where the topic was, of course, President Biden. So, are they signaling, are some of the party heads signaling to Biden to maybe it's time for him to step aside? I mean, you've got Nancy Pelosi saying that, you got Jim Clyburn, who's as you know, widely regarded as a kingmaker, saying, you know, he would support Kamala Harris if Biden weren't in the race. Are they signaling not so quietly to exit stage left Biden? And is it going to do any good? Does anybody want to? Wilmer, you seem like you might want to comment on that.
Yes, there are different signals coming from different angles at different wavelengths. So if you parse what Nancy Pelosi said, she didn't come out and say, absolutely not. Joe Biden's going to be our candidate. Joe Biden's going to be our president. And I stand behind Joe Biden 1,000%. Clyburn didn't say that either. So they are now making room for the discussion when they could be closing the door to the discussion. President Obama came out and said, or at least it's reported that he said to Joe Biden, this is a tough road in front of you, and it just got tougher. And then you've got Lloyd Doggett from Texas saying, Joe, you got to go. So
he didn't parse any words.
No, not at all. And I think that's very telling, particularly as there's also now discussion about moving the Democratic convention up to July, the end of July, the 21st of July.
Wow. Okay. Well, according to a CBS YouGovernment poll, 72% of registered voters don't believe Biden has the mental and cognitive health to be president. But, you know, do we believe the polls? The polls predicted Hillary Clinton would win up to very last minute. So the pollsters do lie. And the New York Times called for Biden to relinquish the nomination, while a Democratic official told NBC News it's not politically smart for Biden to step down. Let's talk about that. What are the consequences if Biden were to step down? Seth?
The consequences if Biden were to step down? I mean, it's hard to imagine the nominee would become, well, I guess the question is, Does he step down as the nominee? Does he step down as the president? Those are two very important different things. But
I'm talking about the nominee. Yeah. I want to talk about the nominee.
If he makes the argument, I'm not really up for running for re-election, immediately the question is, but you're okay to be leader of the free world right now? There would be immediately a ton of pressure on him to simply resign the presidency and make Kamala Harris president. But regardless of whether that happens, Kamala Harris would have overwhelming support among DNC, among the delegates going to the convention, and other party insiders, to be just sort of the heir apparent. I mean, she's just been sort of tapped for that role. That doesn't mean there wouldn't be challengers to that. There would be plenty of other candidates who would be, I think, would make themselves known. We've seen from Gavin Newsom, governor of California. We've seen from a few other folks at least some pretty strong interest in running. And there would be something of a media frenzy about who the actual nominee would be. But I have a hard time envisioning anyone other than Kamala Harris getting that. Not really clear whether she would be more or less popular than Biden is right now. My guess is it would actually be pretty similar to where Biden is right now.
Dr. Andre, I want you to weigh in on that, because I think Kamala Harris has had some interesting poll results. I mean, she's not been as popular in some aspects, but Seth feels as though she would win the vote within the Democratic community. But what about in a larger election? Do you think Kamala Harris could win an election? She couldn't even get the nominations to become president.
Well, I mean, this has been the challenge, and this is the reason why Joe Biden ran for re-election again. There are a couple of things. Like, once it was clear that Donald Trump was probably going to win the Republican nomination, there's a certain fear of putting an unknown or untested candidate against Donald Trump. Joe Biden has the claim to fame that he's the only person that has beaten Donald Trump in an election. So people decided that a rematch would actually be a safer bet than actually trying a newer, younger candidate against Trump. Against whom he's going to pull out all of the types of nasty stops that he would pull against any of his opponents. Second, if we look back, and so we've got to not just think about now, and I'll get to now later, but we have to think about, what polls look like late last year and early this year. Joe Biden actually performed better in head-to-head matchups against Donald Trump than other candidates, including Kamala Harris. So we weren't just thinking about the folks who actually did try to run against Biden, but thinking about those who, were hypothetically set up. So if we were looking at Gavin Newsom, if we were looking at Kamala Harris or Pete Buttigieg, like, these are folks who, they just weren't standing up as well in polls against them. So that also gave Biden another type of cachet. It's an entirely different situation if Biden has to drop out because he is deemed too sick to be able to run for office. Some of the most recent polling that's actually been done in the last couple of days suggests that Harris, of the hypothetical candidates, is the one that's in the strongest position to be able to be competitive against Donald Trump. But there are a couple of things to point out against that. One, it's probably because of high name recognition, which she deserves, being Vice President of the United States. If we look at sort of all the head-to-head matchups, everything is within the margin. She's doing better, but we can't necessarily say that statistically she's doing better compared to any of the other candidates or even compared to Joe Biden. And so that's what makes this really risky and really uncertain. And then I think there does come the question that a lot of people have had about Vice President Harris, about whether or not sort of the intersection of her racial and her gender identity actually served to be a liability. That's part of the reason why we think sometimes her general kind of approval numbers and favorability numbers haven't been as high as some people would have liked to have seen, because we think that she's being a victim of racism and sexism at the same time. So, I mean, I think what the polling data suggests is that from a statistical standpoint, Biden is probably in a comparable position to Harris. And so switching them out might not be you know, might not be a bad thing. But just from a practical standpoint, it's a huge risk to change candidates this late in the game. And while the DNC infrastructure will be there to support a new Democratic nominee, if it comes to that, this is a really fraught process. And so there are some forces that would actually suggest that inertia might be the better thing. And then at that point, the strategy should be, okay, let's remind people who the opponent is. So you have to make this sort of an element of negative partisanship. You might think that, you know, Joe Biden is doddering, but he has people behind him. There's a succession plan. You could see Kamala Harris is in place if he really can't perform his job. But it becomes a question of, do you want somebody who has been convicted of crimes, of felonies, to be president of the United States? And in particular, do you want somebody who's president of the United States who has now just been told by the Supreme Court that he has immunity over a lot of things in his life while he's president of the United States? Do you want somebody to have that type of power, who in the past has kind of demonstrated his you know, ability to want to flout norms and do things that a lot of people find unethical?
You know, we have to take a quick break. Wilma, I know you want to respond to that, but we got to take a 30-second break. So when we come back, we're going to continue that. And I want to also bring up the name of Michelle Obama, who is trouncing Trump in the polls. We'll be back in a minute.
This July 4th, WPFW presents Let America Be America, From Midnight Until Midnight. Langston Hughes wrote in this epic 1936 poem, "There's never been equality for me, nor freedom in this homeland of the free. For millions of people in America, those words still ring true." Throughout the day, you'll hear music, activists, and artists, both contemporary and ancestors, who fought for freedom and who continue to resist. That's Let America Be America on WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
And welcome back to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. You are listening to a deep dive discussion into whether President Joseph Biden should continue to seek the nomination for the Democratic Party, or whether he should step aside and allow someone else to take a shot at that. Dr. Andrea Gillespie is joining us. Dr. Wilma J. Leon III and Seth Maskett are our guests this morning. Dr. Leon, you wanted to comment on that. Let me just say this, though. Andrea, it sounds like you're saying that Kamala would be a comparable candidate to Biden. But we don't need comparable. The Democrats don't need comparable. They need somebody that can actually beat Trump. And comparable means you're already behind Trump. Don't we need someone else? Okay, that's my two cents, Dr. Leon.
Well, Andra and Seth are right. In fact, I would nominate or suggest that they get jobs messaging for the DNC and for the ticket, because they're making the message, they're making the point, better than Joe Biden, better than Kamala Harris. They're absolutely right. Donald Trump is horrible. And in all of his horror, it's a dead even race. Kamala Harris, if we go back to the 2020 campaign, she was horrible. She didn't even get, 4%? She was the first one to drop out. She's a horrible candidate. She might be a decent vice president, and some could debate that. She's a horrible candidate. She's the sous chef of the word salad. So this is a huge problem for the Democrats that they created themselves by, first of all, not allowing serious competition during the primary process. So swapping out Biden now will bring a lot of people to say, basically, you're imposing a candidate on us when you did not allow us to go through the normal process in the first place. I think at the end of this, it's going to be Gavin Newsom and Gretchen Whitmer. How they get there, that's another question. Mm-hmm. But I think that's what we're going to see. I'm not advocating that, But that's what I see coming out of this field. And when you look at the battleground states, you look at Arizona, you look at Nevada, you look at North Carolina, you look at Florida, you look at Texas. How does Joe Biden get to 270? If we stick with the polling, if we use the polling as our analysis, and you look at the battleground states, you look at Georgia, and Trump is ahead in those states outside the margin of error.
Okay,
how does Joe Biden get to 270?
So what has to happen here? What do the Democrats have to do? Do they have to convince Joe Biden to step aside, put it another, would Kamala Harris automatically be, she's the presumptive nominee, would she automatically be that person? I know that some African-American delegates are saying if she's not, they are going to basically abandon the party, made very serious threats. Is it more consequential to leave him in or to take him out? And how would that actually manifest? Would you have to have a contested convention coming up this summer in July? Or, I don't know, Seth, you're familiar with the process. Would it have to automatically, how would it become a contested convention? Because I know that's generally if no candidate gets enough votes on the first vote, then it becomes contested. Do you foresee that happening, or your thoughts about that?
So it used to be historically decisions were made at conventions. That's before the reforms of the late 1960s and early 1970s. A convention would start and a party wouldn't necessarily know who their presidential nominee was going to be. There was a lot of horse trading that would occur, and people would make arguments about who would best represent different wings of the party, and they would come up with some sort of consensus. We don't live in that world. This is all sort of fought out in primaries and caucuses long before the convention, and the convention just kind of, officially ratifies that, and it's, like a four-day press conference for the party. If Biden were first, there's no way he is not the nominee unless he decides to step down. There's no mechanism by which a party just fires its presumptive nominee. The delegates coming to this, to the Democratic convention, were all picked because they were loyal to Joe Biden. They feel very strongly about his capabilities. They like his presidency. Many of them were his supporters 4 years ago, which was a decision that, the party made, that, like, weighing all the things that we care about, weighing the, different wings of the party, different our policy priorities, the importance of people of color, the importance of women, the importance of progressives and other groups within the party. Joe Biden was the candidate they came up with,
suppose they've changed their mind. Suppose those delegates have changed their mind since the debate. Are they legally bound still to vote for Joe Biden as long as he's on the ticket?
They're not legally bound. They're also probably the people least likely on this planet to change their minds about Joe Biden. But if they were to somehow not vote for him, these are muscles the party hasn't exercised in about over 50 years. But yes, theoretically, they could vote for someone else. It could be an open convention, in which several different candidates make their names known. If he doesn't get the majority of delegates on that first ballot, again, I have a really hard time believing we're in that situation. But in theory, yes, they have the power to pick someone else.
Okay, so does anybody here, Dr. Andra?
So, basically the people who are going are pledged to Joe Biden, and the overwhelming majority of the delegates who are headed to Chicago got their positions because of the proportions of the vote that Joe Biden got. And you had to meet minimum thresholds. There are very few people, in terms of who are uncommitted, for instance. So what would end up having to happen is Joe Biden has to make the decision to not run for president, at which point he releases his delegates to sort of have the open convention free for all that would happen. And then what would happen is all of the sort of new candidates who would be kind of waiting in the wings are going to have to make their appeals to these delegates. And then these delegates would vote. And then whoever gets a majority of those votes would win. And if it has to go to multiple votes in order to make that happen, that would happen. So just from a timeline standpoint, time is actually, from a small standpoint, on the Democrat side in that if Joe Biden chooses to drop out before the election with enough time then is to allow people to put campaigns together.
You mean before the convention?
Before the convention, excuse me. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Then it gives Democrats time to be able to regroup, give the opportunity for candidates to kind of make their pitches to delegates before mm-hmm. the convention, right? So if something were to happen after the convention, then it gets super duper messy. Yeah. Even I don't understand it, but like there is a way to make this happen that somewhat democratic.
What about Kamala Harris? Does she just have to just, be part of the fold of all the candidates that are seeking she wouldn't automatically become the... Okay.
Yeah.
No. All right.
And also, it's important to understand, and Seth and Andra are correct. If some of this depends on when Joe Biden steps out, assuming that he would. To Andra's point, if he steps out before the convention, then we have an open convention, and we're back to the 1960s. It is a free for all. It also the question also comes, what happens to the campaign money? What happens to the money from the Biden-Harris campaign? Mm. That money, I think most of that money gets released back to the DNC. And the DNC then is able to distribute those funds as they deem appropriate. The delegates
it goes
to the DNC because think about it, at that point Gavin Newsom doesn't have a campaign to send money to.
No, I understand. I'm saying it should go to the DNC, but the DNC should therefore put it behind whoever gains
that was my point.
Okay.
The rules of the convention allow the delegates to vote their conscience, mm-hmm. but they will tend to vote for the candidates that they were committed to.
Okay. Mm. So let's talk a little bit about this short list. This could get really long if it becomes an open convention. I want to talk about Michelle Obama because the polls say she would trounce Trump in a one-on-one. She's 11 percentage points ahead of Trump. Andra, you have written about the Obamas. Your thoughts about that? She says she's not running for president.
And I take her seriously when she says that. I'm actually working on a book about Michelle Obama right now specifically. She has always said that she is not a politician. I take her at her word. And I think it's also important to kind of keep in mind that the reason why she's doing so well against Donald Trump right now is because she's a hypothetical candidate. And as first ladies tend to have higher approval ratings than their husbands do because they're not politicians. The moment you become a politician is the moment you start to get treated like a politician. Case in point, Hillary Clinton. Both before and after, because she always seemed like she was super political. So I think the moment she enters the race is the moment that like that New Yorker cover, like that had her looking like an Afro militant, right, kind of comes back to bear, and you're going to start to see those numbers come down. And I also, we also have to point and keep in mind that while Michelle Obama is an accomplished professional in her own right, she's also a political novice in some way, shape, or form. So she's never held office before. She's never held an appointed position other than being married to the president of the United States, which has certain power and cachet to it. Right. So I think it would be a question of, do you go with somebody who is really not an experienced politician just because they are beloved by the American people? So I think that's incredibly risky and a non-starter.
Basically, you're saying that's a pipe dream that Michelle Obama is going to take on Trump and win and deliver us all out of this political, I won't say hell, but. So the short list also includes California Governor Gavin Newsom, North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, who's a billionaire and has inherited the Hyatt's billions. Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear, and possibly others, who knows, maybe Bernie Sanders might decide to throw his hat back into the ring, who knows, Elizabeth Warren. So, okay, Wilmer, I heard your comments. I know you've pretty much said Gavin Newsom. Let's look at Gavin Newsom. California is in shambles. Why is anybody going to vote for him to be president?
Well, because he's a good looking white guy that looks great in a suit.
That's the truth. I know.
And standing next to Donald Trump, good looking white dude, young guy, governor of California. He can raise money. He can make a claim of some foreign experience based upon his relationship with President Xi in China. He does these trips to China. But let me quickly make a point that this is really going to be, we know that all elections are about turnout, but this is really, if this is really going to be about turnout based upon the numbers of the dual haters, the folks that say they don't want either candidate to be elected. And so there are a lot of people that may very well stay home. And you can also look at an increase in numbers for Robert Kennedy Jr., possibly Dr. West and Jill Stein. So will a Democrat be able to pull back into the party the dual haters and a lot of the folks that are looking at third party candidates? That's the question, I think, that people really need to be asking themselves. And the final point relative to polling, look, we keep hearing all this discussion about Donald Trump pulling all these African-American votes. Oh, he's now up to 17, 18, 19% of the African-American vote. He's got 17% of black males. That was the same chatter we heard in 2020. He got 6%. So there's a big difference between what you'll tell a pollster and what you'll do when you go to the polls.
Okay, and Doctor, I want Dr. Andra to comment on that black male vote, because I know you've done quite a bit of research around that. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not quite sure where the 6% is coming from. So it's true that AP Votecast and Edison polls kind of came up with different numbers in 2012, but I don't think it was 6. My issue with the polls about black people is, one, again, these are polls that pull independent samples of different black people at a time. You were talking about much bigger margins of error. Most of the national surveys that are sort of sounding these alarm bells about black voters are based on really small sample sizes of black voters.
Okay.
300, huge margins of error, right? There's a ton of noise there. There's a lot of variability. I wouldn't put much stock in them just because they're really not talking to a lot of black folks. There are some that do suggest that, you know, on the margins, Trump could possibly do better with larger sample sizes. But most of the stuff that we're looking at is few and far between. And so therefore, you can't even sub-sample to kind of break it down by gender, because once you do that, we really are talking about, you talk to 100 people, and I margins of error plus or minus 10. I can't do anything with that.
So, Seth.
And that's my point.
This governor, Illinois governor, J.B. Pritzker, it's been said that he could swoop in and basically buy the nomination. Your thoughts about that?
I think we had a great example in just 4 years ago. We all might remember when Democrats were briefly panicking at the beginning of part of the year that despite all these Democrats, there were literally two dozen who were running for president, that somehow none of them seemed like they could do it. People started trolling around. We need some sort of fantasy electability candidate. And suddenly Mike Bloomberg started throwing his name around. And the idea was like, this is clearly an electable candidate. Again, white guy looked pretty good in a suit and was a billionaire. And the thought that was like, well, he can buy his way into the nomination. Well, he spent $500 million and he got a handful of delegates from American Samoa, and that was it. This isn't really something that's for sale. And buying the convention delegates would be an even harder job.
All right. Seth Maskett was our guest, as well as Dr. Andre Gillespie and Wilma Leon. Unfortunately, we are out of time this morning. Perhaps we'll come back and do a part two on this after the convention. Biden better hope the seniors remember to vote, because they are really going to be part of that Democratic vote. Thank you all for listening. That concludes today's What's at Stake. Thank you to my guests and to my engineer, Michael Nocella. I have production assistance from Dr. James Steele and Elizabeth D. White. I'm Verna Avery Brown. In the words of the late Nelson Mandela, it always seems impossible until it's done. Up next, Wake Up and Stay Woke with Dr. E. Faye Williams.
This July 4th, WPFW presents Let America Be America, From Midnight Until Midnight. Langston Hughes wrote in this epic 1936 poem, "There's never been equality for me, nor freedom in this homeland of the free." For millions of people in America, those words still ring true. Throughout the day, you'll hear music, activists, and artists, both contemporary and ancestors, who fought for freedom and who continue to resist. That's Let America Be America on WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time. Born in 1899, Edward Kennedy Ellington ranks as the greatest all-around figure, composer, arranger, orchestrator, bandleader, conductor, piano accompanist, soloist, and musical thinker. On Thursday, July 11th, from 5 a.m. until midnight, WPFW honors Ellington on the occasion of his 125th birth year with Ellington 125, a celebration beyond category. We will tickle the sonic keys with all things Ellington, from his three-minute instrumentals to his theatrical scores and sacred concerts, all in support of building our relocation fund. That's Ellington 125, a celebration beyond category. Thursday, July 11th, from 5 a.m. until midnight on WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
On Sunday, July 7th, 4 to 8 p.m., WPFW is presenting a fundraising evening of roots, rock, reggae at Mango Cafe, 4719 Annapolis Road, Bladensburg, Maryland, featuring Proverbs reggae band with Z Lion and special guest Freedom in Soroma VL. Proceeds to benefit WPFW.
Details at Eventbrite. WPFW Reggae Concert, Eventbrite.com.
PACA, Pan-African Community Action, will be holding the Community Town Hall, The Harm of Crime Bills, and the Future of Community Power in Chaka City. On Saturday, July 13th, from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., D.C. residents are invited to discuss how the Secure D.C. Crime Bill targets the Black working class and criminalizes our youth, and how to develop real people-centered solutions to community safety. There will be speakers, group exercises, lunch, and a performance by the Afro-Go-Go Roots Collective, Crank Lukongo Unplugged. The Harm of Crime Bills and the Future of Community Power in Chocolate City, Saturday, July 13th, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the RISE Demonstration Center, 2730 Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue, Southeast D.C. More information and registration can be found online, PACA, that's P-A-C-A, crimebilltownhall.eventbrite.com. WPFW is your station for jazz and justice, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The Pacifica National Board and the WPFW Local Station Board will be voting on a proposed Pacifica Bylaws Amendment between July 10th and August 24th of 2024. Information on the amendment, about how vacancies are filled on local station boards, and about the process will be posted on the pacifica.org website.
No social justice issue or movement can escape the spotlight of the Latino Media Collective. The Latino Media Collective delivers consequential coverage from the biggest countries in South America to the smallest enclaves of Central America and the Caribbean, and is available on SoundCloud, iTunes Podcast, and Google Play Music. The Latino Media Collective is recorded in WPFW studios and airs Fridays at 1 p.m. on WPFW Washington.
The talk show Africa Now airs Wednesdays at 1 p.m. It's a modern view on historical issues concerning the entire African world, addressing how African people are participating in globalization, ways in which the rest of the world continues.